India Whiskey. My name is Dick. You will also hear Mel, Kilo 2, Kilo Echo Yankee. Mel and Dick attempt to organize this thing called the Technical Men, in which a clan of amateur radio operators get together and help each other understand how all the electronics works, how to make it work better. Not quite sure how many people are out celebrating the 4th of July and will actually be available for the TechNet tonight, but we'll soon find out. If Joe W2 Romeo Yankee Yankee signs in, he signed in last week and we didn't get to him, so he'll be on the top of the list if he signs in tonight, or when he signs in. Person signs in for the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. So please give me your call letters and name and that word yes right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
And 2EO, Virgin yes.
Juliet November with yes.
N2MB no.
Okay, we heard Rich, Alex, and Barry in that order. Anyone else?
K-E-Y, can I make one statement before we go any further?
Yeah, go right ahead, Mel.
Hey, Dick, I've gotten an awful lot of emails this week. Is it possible that we can limit any discussion to about 15 minutes so we take all the questions, and if they need further explanation, further discussion, come back to them? In other words, go continuously in order so that we don't skip anyone. Joe, as you mentioned, has called in a number of weeks, and we have not yet gotten to his questions, Dick. Over.
It does sound like a good suggestion. I think you're saying there are times when we've gotten on to one subject for a solid hour, so limit it to 15 minutes. You're trying to cut back my long-windedness. Okay. Makes sense. Once again, we've got Rich, Alex, and Wesley and Barry. Anyone else to sign into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time.
WB2IKT, no traffic.
IKT with a no. All right, let's start off with the first questioner. And maybe it's going to be a little bit light tonight. Rich, N2EO, what's going on in Whitestone?
Good evening, Dick. K2RIW, Tech Den, Weimark, N2EO. Got a question on, well, Dick, you wrote the book pretty much on the 4CX250B, which is parallel kilowatt, and Mel knows Colin, so I'll address it to both of you guys. I picked up a Colin 62S1 transverter, 6 2 meter transverter, and specs say minimum output 65 watts BEP. I'm getting 65 watts exactly on 6 meters, and that looks pretty good. On 2 meters, I'm getting about 80 watts out, but a couple of things. It won't neutralize properly. In other words, the dip in plate current and the peak in power output coincide on 6, but they're way, way out on 2 meters. It's not oscillating. It's stable, but the difference between peak output and dip is about 100 mils. And also what's curious is the grid current is normal on 6 meters, but the meter is going negative, backwards, on 2 meters. Normally you would think that's a gassy 2, but it's working fine on 6. On 2 it's going backwards. Dick, what I tried doing was using a Hewlett Packard 427A meter with a, let it recycle. Okay, with a detector probe, you know, an RF probe rather, element, and I know that the interval electrode capacitance on the tube on 2 meters, in other words, minimum feed through. When I do that, it still does not coincide the dip and peak on 2 meters, and at that point on the neutralization capacitor, I get almost no output on 6 meters. The 62S1 originally came with a 4X150A, which was flat as a pancake, and I know people have put 4CX250Bs in there. I got a brand new one, factory fresh, brand new 4CX250B. It has very, very good emission because I had to bring up the bias control to get the idle current down. Wonder what you think, Dick, and maybe Mel has some ideas on this one, too. K2RIW, TechNet Limark, N2EO.
Now, Roger, the person thinks considerations with that.
Go ahead, Mel. Sounds like you've been there.
Yeah, a considerable number of people have made similar complaints about that particular transverter. One of the things that I remember that my friend, who is no longer alive, unfortunately, he found after a considerable amount of very deep research onto that radio, that piece of equipment, this socket that the ceramic tube fit into, the way that socket, if you know how a ceramic tube or the 4CX4X or 4CX150 series was constructed, the sockets, early sockets, did have their problems, literally. Rich, he got a scrutinized. I remember he told me the socket very closely, but he wound up replacing the socket over.
Okay, interesting, Mel. This looks like an early socket, because I was wondering about that. It has discrete capacitors on the socket. It's not an iMac air system socket like an SK620 or an SK630. What would you recommend, Mel?
They did come up with a much better socket later on. I don't remember because of going back a good number of years. Maybe Dick could put some light on that subject. Think you've used many sockets for the 4X250B series, etc. I remember that socket, some of them used to like sort of deteriorate. I guess that's the best way to describe a deteriorated socket. What did you use, Dick, in your amplifiers? Over.
My original PAL kilowatt amplifier for 432 megacycles used SK610, I think it is, sockets. There is a disc screen bypass capacitor that lays pretty flat to the chassis built into that socket. The UHF versions of the socket, which I never used, but I think they would have worked better, the 620 and 630, the screen grid assembly is a kind of a pedestal that rises up above the chassis floor. And the built-in screen grid capacitor of the socket is quite important because the vast majority of the plate capacitance is plate capacitance between the plate and the screen grid, which is the closest thing to it. So you want this great big swing of RF voltage on the plate when it's producing power for you on 6 or 2 meters or 432. But you want the screen grid voltage to hold steady, so you're looking for an extremely low inductance from screen grid to ground. Let me drop. And the socket with the built-in screen grid capacitor is an important part of that. There's something else to worry about, and that is the brand new socket has silver-plated fingers, the ring on the screen grid portion of the 4CX250B2, I think is also silver-plated, and depending on the number of times that the tube is plugged into the socket, depends on how fast you wear away that silver plating. When you get down to the brass or beryllium oxide or whatever it is of the actual fingers, worked on scraping away the beautiful silver plating. The amount, the quality of the contact you get there is nowhere near as good. The amount of RF current that flows through all of those fingers of the screen grid to ground, screen grid, the fingers of the socket with its bypass capacitor, a significant amount of RF energy flows there. It's worse on 432 than it would be on 2 meters. On 432, I've had the problem where when I run the amplifier at full blast, a kilowatt of output with a pair of tubes in parallel, where the socket had been well worn, occasionally the tube will weld itself into those fingers of the socket. The current flow through those fingers is that great to create welding. Let me drop. Another thing worth being concerned about is that 4CX250Bs always have a significant amount of secondary emission of the screen grid. Therefore, when you monitor screen grid current, it is the strongest indication of whether or not the tube is being properly loaded and properly resonated. When the plate voltage swing is allowed to go as far as it wants to, so that instantaneously when you're running Class C in particular, when the plate voltage swings to very low voltages, under that condition, you will see a whole lot of positive screen grid current. Those electron cloud comes through the cathode, through the control grid. It sees this plus 350 volts or whatever on the screen grid. And if those electrons look through the holes of the screen grid and don't see a much more positive voltage on the plate, they don't go to the plate. They stick to the screen and get a whole lot of positive current. Let me drop. However, with the opposite event, if the plate circuit is tuned out of resonance, tuned too high or too low in frequency, or if it's tuned too heavy in loading, then the swing of RF voltage on the plate is drastically decreased. If, for instance, you're putting a 1,500 or 2,000 volts on the plate, and if the plate voltage swing is not going very far, then at the instant that cloud of electrons comes through the screen, and it looks through those holes and sees this great big positive voltage on the plate, they don't stick to the screen, they go through the holes, they go to the plate, and in the process, the few that do hit the screen create secondary emission. One or two electrons, per se, in one little section, hit the screen grid. That releases a larger number of electrons that leave the screen grid and go toward the plate. The bottom line of that is you get negative screen current. So, as I said, monitoring screen current is a strong indication of resonance being out or loading being heavy if you've got negative screen grid current. Let me drop. One further piece of evidence that I've had with all of my experience with 4CX250B tubes is that the amount of shielding you get between input circuit and output circuit, as long as you've got a well-bypassed socket, is so great that built-in oscillation of a tube is extremely unlikely, unless you've got a rather poor layout where by some other means, some of the RF voltage in the plate circuit on top of the chassis manages to sneak back to the screen grid circuit on the bottom of the chassis and create feedback. All of my experience with 4CX250B tubes is that I was getting good linearity, good efficiency, good power output, but the dip in the plate current when you're tuning the plate and maximum power output does not correspond. Perfect neutralization is something I've never achieved. It's nice to have it, but I'm not sure you've got to have it. As long as the thing is stable and gives you the linearity you're worrying about, the fact that it's not perfectly neutralized may be a little bit on the academic side. One other thing worth worrying about, as I see it, Rich, is that when you're trying to do neutralization, let me drop, you want all gain of the tube, electron gain, to cease in order to do neutralization. In order to do that, it is my belief that you must remove all plate voltage, remove all screen grid voltage, and operate with only control grid bias voltage present in order to do neutralization. If there's any screen voltage left or plate voltage left, Although the gain of the tube, the electron gain will be small, that gain will dominate, and therefore neutralization will become more difficult. So my bottom line is monitor screen current. The perfect neutralization is academic, but if you still think you want it, I think you have to remove all plate voltages during the time you're doing the neutralization procedure. N2EO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, Dick, very, very interesting. Well, see, I removed just the screen. I thought I could leave the plate. So maybe I'll go back over it and see what I can come up with, taking off screen and plate. I want to ask Mel, and I know we want to go on to somebody else here, but Mel, I have a book here. I have to look and see if there were any updates to the 62S1. Did Collins have an update for an SK610 or an SK620 or an SK630 socket, or is it sufficient to change those? See, in the manual, it shows 820 picofarad bypass capacitors on the socket. It says 8 of them. Maybe they go bad. What did your friend do? It looks like that PA cage is quite tight. It looks like really quite a project to get in there and change the socket. Dick, you're running the net, so I'm going to turn it back to you. K2RIW, TechNet, Weimark, and 2EO.
You know, one of the things that I'm concerned about, Rich, is that the SK610, 620, 630 sockets are considerably larger in diameter of the portion of the socket that sits on the top of the chassis. So from the actual circular hole you drill in the chassis to allow the current socket you're using to be installed, I'm not sure of the exact number, but I'm going to guess there's a healthy quarter inch of additional radius required for the screen grid assembly. And if the walls of your plate amplifier plate circuit cage are close enough nearby, is there enough room to install the socket? Maybe you'll have to move the hole over a little bit. Maybe you'll have to put some dimples in that wall or notches in the wall to make room for the socket. Installing the socket could be a pain. I'm going to turn it over to Mel to see if he knows of anyone having done that. And having seen the amplifier, maybe he knows, is there enough room for that, what I believe is a larger diameter socket. I'm not positive you've got to have it, but I think you get a little bit better operation with the real screen grid bypass socket, any one of that series, 610, 20, or 30. The 630, I think, is primarily intended for UHF operation. K2KEY, K2RIW. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, this is K2KEY. You know, I'm searching my memory, of course. This is going back a good, good many years. I could say poor Joel Visa was quite a physicist, I should say, and never really did much in the way of publicizing a lot of his work, which was, I have to say, very impressive. I remember the socket situation with him very well. He did manage somehow to get it in there. I think, now I'm not going, don't quote me on this, but I remember him making a piece of aluminum plate up that he added on in there, that he cut the hole in the new piece of aluminum plate and then square cut it to fit in there. Now why I remember that, maybe I'm wrong, but I'm 99% sure. I remember also a discussion we had briefly on that, and he said that he noticed that, some overcoupling, that if he did some overcoupling, slightly overcoupling, that under those conditions, he had better linearity. That's all I can remember. I'm sorry, as I should say, so long ago I just can't really recall the nitty-gritty. All right, listen, we can discuss this. Dick, I think we should pick up the next one, over.
Yeah, all of my experience with 4CX250Bs tells me you do get greater linearity with heavier coupling. which means you're resonating the plate circuit in such a way that you get near maximum power output or go a little bit on the lean side of plate capacitance. In other words, you're rocking your plate capacitor or its equivalent back and forth, and you're looking for the dip in plate current, but you're monitoring power output. Peak the power output, it won't be at the exact dip of the plate current, but then move the tuning capacitor a little bit lower in capacitance. Tune the plate circuit a little bit on the high side. There's at least two reasons for that. You get a little bit better linearity, and as the tube heats up, it is my guess that the screen grid, particularly at UHF frequencies, the screen grid gets warmer, grows mechanically by probably a 10,000th of an inch, but it mechanically grows, moves a little bit closer to the plate, and therefore a little bit more plate capacitance happens. Either that or the ceramic of the tube heating up has a higher dielectric content. I'm not sure which it is. But all 4CX250Bs, as they get warmer, the plate circuit capacitance increases. Therefore, tune it on the low capacitance side or slightly above resonance. With heavy plate loading, you're much further away from the condition where you might get feedback if the neutralization isn't perfect. The tuning becomes more broadband, is not as touchy or sensitive, and the linearity increases. It's the linearity requirement, let me drop. The linearity requirement that makes many people choose the grounded grid service for this whole series of external anode tubes. I don't think you've got to go there. I think you can get more than enough linearity driving the grid. And the nice thing about driving the grid is that in your particular service, probably 2 watts of drive is all that tube needs to give nearly full power output. Whereas if you're driving the cathode, it's going to take more like 25 watts to drive. So it's nowhere near as convenient. Yes, grounded grid gives you a little bit more linearity, but it's a reasonably heavy price to pay for that slight increase. And unless you like running a spectrum analyzer proving that all third order and fifth order harmonics are more than 30 decibels down, and you brag about it when you go on the air, the average person listening to your signal will never know the difference. Until your third order intermodulation distortion products get down to minus 15 or minus 20 dB, the average set of ears are not going to hear it. Yes, if you're running a contest operation and the tent that's 100 feet away from you, somebody else is trying to operate in the exact same band, in that particular circumstance, third order intermods are going to bomb that other guy a lot faster. Most of us don't tend to operate in that situation. Turn it back to you for a final Rich, and then I'll go on to the next person. N2EO, let us know how all these experiments change over the time. K2RIW in a second. You got it, Rich.
Okay, Dick. Well, what I'm gonna do is pull the plate voltage off with the screen and just go over it and take potluck on it. Last quick question. Will that negative grid current damage the tube on 2 meters, and also on 2 meters, it's running about 300 mils. And they run about 800 volts on the plate, so that's about 240 watts input. Is that too much, Dick? I don't wanna cook it. By the way, did you know that IMAC is going crazy with the price on not only on the 8877s, but I didn't pay that for it, but would you believe a brand new 4CX250B now from RF Parts with a current date code is $379. And if you want, they got a few left with old date codes for $219. I managed to get this one brand new for $150. Remember back in the 60s, they were $20 a piece.
Yeah, the $20 a piece, though, was surplus market. I think in those days, they were listing more like $75 or whatever. It's extremely rugged tube. The FAA used a zillion of them in all of their transmitters, and they would change them every year or two, even though the tube is probably good for 20 years of service. They thought they were getting higher reliability out of their transmitters by changing them after a couple of years. So the flea market was flooded with 4CX250Bs, and there were times on the flea market you could buy them for $5. The quickest way to find out if the tube is being overused is to measure the temperature of the air coming off the tube. Keep the temperature of the air below, I think it's 200 degrees centigrade. You can measure that with a candy thermometer. Then you know you're using the tube correctly. The tube itself is rated for 250 watts plate dissipation. Move enough air through the anode of that tube by either the parallel air cooling arrangement, which is used in the parallel kilowatt amplifier, or just by using a big enough blower. Move enough air through the anode of that tube. It will dissipate 500 watts per tube. And I'm not kidding. The 250 watts is only for a certain number of cubic feet per minute of air going through that tube. Let me drop. So, also, with plate voltage on the tube, with screen voltage at zero, the tube still has a little bit of gain, and therefore electronic gain, therefore neutralization will be much more difficult to accomplish. Because any feedback between plate and grid then becomes feed forward by the gain of the tube, if you know what I mean, and it'll confuse you. When it comes to the control grid, you're going to use normal control grid bias, and as long as you don't exceed something like 2 watts of drive on the control grid can take that. Control grid can dissipate 2 watts, screen grid can dissipate 12 watts. Don't exceed either one of those, otherwise terrible things happen within a small number of seconds. Let us know how that goes, Rich. Now we'll go over to Wesley, N2XJN, the man with a lot of curiosity about how science really works. He's assembling what hell of a laboratory to really dig into this. What's the latest over there in Queens, Wesley? N2XJN, K2LIW, and the Tech Man.
Thank you very much, Dave, for giving me the microphone. I'm playing with my toys, and I'm very much satisfied with that. And that's what consumes most of my time. Now, I have a question for you. The last time we were talking about vector network analyzers, and I have a question in regards to vector signal analysis, or vector signal analyzers. These features are very much incorporated in transmitter testers or signal testers, trying to find the properties of unknown signals at most. So, you have a random signal, random noise, or could be one frequency on the number of frequencies, and you want to see the maximum of that signal. Everything that emits, especially with the Tesla coil, especially with the frequency that is the most significant that you can see on the spectrum analyzer, let me drop, has a certain properties. So, I would like to hear your opinion about vector signal analyzers. Dick, back to you, Antoine.
Yeah, when it comes to a spectrum analyzer, which measures amplitude vertically and frequency horizontally and displays it on the screen, a ordinary spectrum analyzer normally does not measure phase angle, only measures amplitudes. And so you can look at the amplitude of what goes in and what the amplitude of what comes out of a circuit and all of the frequency components going in and all of the frequency components coming out in amplitude. When it comes to the word vector, it means you're keeping track of not only amplitude but phase. And a vector network analyzer and a vector signal analyzer has internally to it a signal generator, a highly coherent phase lock loop type signal generator, which sequentially goes through a number of frequencies of excitation to the circuit under test. And then either of those instruments, vector signal analyzer or vector network analyzer, looks at the amplitude and the phase of the signal that is responding from your circuit under test. Let me drop. So there is a coherence here. The good news about a vector network analyzer and a vector signal analyzer is that because of the phase coherence between the excitation signal and the response signal, the instrument is able to use something called a synchronous detector. The magic of a synchronous detector is it has extreme sensitivity. It can dig many decibels below the noise of the response that might be coming out of your circuit under test. That's the good news. The bad news is that a vector signal analyzer and vector network analyzer only operates on a coherent excitation. There must be a very narrow band, coherent, pure sine wave signal under normal circumstances going into the circuit under test for either of those instruments to properly get response out of its coherent synchronous detector and therefore get all of that extra sensitivity and dynamic range it's capable of giving. Now, when it comes to a Tesla coil, let me drop. There are many kinds of Tesla coil. The very first one I ever saw, way back in the middle 1950s when I was first getting into ham radio, a buddy of mine built a Tesla coil. His particular Tesla coil used an 8072 as an oscillator in the primary circuit of the Tesla coil. I think it was running at something like 3 megacycles or so. And it had a beautiful, nice, big spark coming out of the secondary, great, big, tall column of the Tesla coil. I think that spark would jump a gap of something like 3 or 4 inches. And it was an extremely soft side of spark. You could put your hand there. You didn't feel the current. You saw the spark go from the top of the Tesla coil over to your hand. As you move your hand closer and further away, the spark became longer and shorter, a little bit brighter, and not so bright, but the current was somewhat limited because it had a real coherent oscillator running only a few watts in the primary. The modern-day Tesla coils, everybody wants to build the highest power they can. They want to get the biggest possible spark. They want to get the most amount of noise, and they flipped over to a different kind of philosophy. Let me drop. The majority of the Tesla coil circuits that people build these days use as high a power source as they can put into the primary. Quite often it consists of a 4,000 volt step up, many kilowatt transformer. That in turn, if they were putting that into a tube circuit, would require a very large tube to oscillate and produce the right amount of power. They take the shortcut and build some kind of a spark gap arrangement. The spark gap arrangement creates huge pulses of current between that 4,000 volt in my example, 4,000 volt step-up transformer running at kilowatts. That spark gap is putting these pulses of current with the sparking noise into the primary circuit, and you get a lot of power out of the Tesla coil. That's the good news. The bad news is that because you're getting a much higher power, you've now got to worry about its safety. Putting your hand near the secondary is not a safer thing to do. But because you have this very non-coherent sparking signal into the primary, where each half of the cycle of the 60 cycle power that people are usually using to excite it, let me drop, the exact instant of when it fires, how long it fires, how long the spark gap exists, and what is the actual frequency and phase angle of the spark gap transmitter that is firing the primary, that although it's high in power and gives you a nice 60 cycle buzzing sound out of the Tesla coil, it is an extremely non-coherent source. As such, under normal circumstances, when it's being excited in the normal way, it is my belief that you're not going to get anywhere near the normal response out of a vector signal analyzer or a vector network analyzer, because the source itself is essentially incoherent. Therefore, the synchronous demodulator that's built into the analyzer doesn't really work, doesn't work very well, doesn't give the right response. A spectrum analyzer will tell you amplitude of the frequencies, and an oscilloscope will allow you to see the ring down of each one of the pulses going into the primary and what's happening out of the secondary. And the secondary is a resonant circuit that rings like a bell every 16 milliseconds, each half cycle of what's going in. But the timing of those is going to be a little bit erratic. You'll have to experiment with the synchronous
synchronization of the oscilloscope so that the spike of rise, the positive going voltage of rise out of each individual ring coming out of the Tesla coil is being synchronized by the oscilloscope. There may be ways of taking a vector, a signal analyzer, and similarly synchronizing it. There I'm not sure. I haven't used vector signal analyzers anywhere near as much. But as you can see, the good news is that your spark gapping primary power is giving you a lot of watts, kilowatts, peak amperes, and whatever. But its non-coherence is making life of precise measurement a bit more difficult. N2XJN, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, this is N2XJN. What I use is, I do not use any AC at all. What I use is pulsed DC. So there is a generator that is pulsing the DC, and the DC is delivered with the amplification to the primer of the transformer, high voltage transformer, and the secondary is actually responding to whatever gets to the primary. That's the first point. And I'm trying to find the sense of the nonsense of investing $2,000 in spectrum network analyzer, which actually will have things, actually it's spectrum network impedance analyzer, which is a Hewlett-Packard device, or just stay with a good quality spectrum analyzer, because I'm going to get nonsense and I'm not going to see anything from that. That's the first question. And the second question is that the vector signal analysis in other application will allow the modulation of the common mobile radio signals. And my question is that, of course, the AM, FM, PM signals, and kind of digital signals. Does that mean that this signal could be demodulated and retrieved, or they could be only in the visual form on the screen? Back to you, Andrew.
Yeah, very fascinating that your particular Tesla coil is using a DC pulse signal generator to excite the primary winding of the Tesla coil. I am curious, is there a spark gap, is number one. Number two, how many volts and roughly how many amperes and how long? In other words, the way you're pulsing the primary, you're pulsing it, let me pick a number, 100,000 times per second. Is it a 10 ampere pulse? And is it some number of volts being applied directly to the primary? Or is it being applied to the primary indirectly by way of a spark gap? Tell me about those DC pulses you're putting into the primary, Wesley. N2XJN, K2RIW.
But a DC pulse is supposed to be square shaped, and the frequency is 20 kilohertz. And the ability to regulate the width of the pulses, that's what actually gets. And the amplification allows to get to anywhere within the voltage from 4 volts up to, let's say, 100 volts, although I have never tried it with that voltage. By using the high voltage transformer, I was able just to safely play with no more than 6,000 volts. And, of course, I can generate much more. I don't need that. I'm not playing with the Tesla coil for fun. I'm playing with the Tesla coil for the results. And what I'm trying to do is realize for myself with an investment of spectrum network impedance analyzer, which is one device, because I don't want to buy three of them. And it's roughly anywhere between $4,500 up to $30,000, if somebody wants to go very high, is sufficient. wind and whether the signal vector analyzer is anything that will give me any usable information. And also, let me jump. The last question that I gave you is, if you have a vector signal analysis within your analyzer, then by demodulation of the common mobile separator signals, also maybe cable TV, can you see these signals only in a graphical form, or you can actually retrieve these signals? So there are two questions. Back to you, Andrew.
Yeah, I've got one further question on the earlier subject, though. 20 kilohertz is the rate at which you're putting in pulses. I think you have some kind of a pulse width control. You can control the number of microseconds or milliseconds of each pulse. That's going to be microseconds. And you said 4 to 100 volts. You can adjust the voltage between 4 and 100. And then you said 6,000 volts secondary. I'm wondering when you talked about 4 volts to 100 volts, was that only voltage applied to the primary winding of the Tesla coil? And when you talked about 6,000 volts, was that voltage coming off the secondary of the Tesla coil, the high voltage probe, or was that going into the primary? And is there any spark gap, or is the pulse generator being applied directly to the primary without a spark gap? And do you happen to know how many amperes of peak current is being applied to the primary? Back to you, Wesley, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Okay, yes, I do have ability to regulate the width of the signal. I never went to 100 volts. The maximum of what I went to was the approximately 3 volts. That gives me with the secondary of the transformer purposely, so it's not that it's not in purpose, it's purposely around 7,000 volts. I am willing to work with no more than 4 to 6,000 volts. And that's what I need. Back to you.
One last question before I proceed. What's your best guess as to the 20 kilohertz pulses that you're applying to the primary? Any guess as to how many amperes is in each one of those pulses peak current? Is it 10 milliamps or 10 amperes, if you happen to know? Go ahead.
The 10 amps will be nowhere near the ability to withhold this kind of current by the coil, but it is probably in. I got shot twice with that, so. It is somewhere within the range of 1 milliamp. Back to you.
1 milliamp of primary current or 1 milliamp of secondary current of the 6,000 volts? Back to you, Wesley.
No. 1 milliamp of secondary coil would be extremely dangerous. It's a primary. Back to you.
And those are very low voltages for many of the Tesla coils that I've seen on YouTube and I've seen people.